This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Home for deep cut discussion of genre films from the VHS. These are your action, your horror, your sci-fi films found on the shelves of your mom and pop video store. I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at retromovienerd.com, where this week we have a review of the 1994 high-octane action thriller Speed, starring Keanu Reeves, Dennis Hopper, and Sandra Bullock. Does all that action surrounding the bus that can't stop stand up? I'll give you a spoiler alert. It's still pretty awesome. But you can find out more at RetroMovieNerd.com right now. Joining me, as always, is the man with plan, the guy who can fly, the Ayatollah of pop culture, Joel LaPuma.
Hey, Chris. It's great to be here. And you can find me at my blog at RazorCandy at razor-andy.com. And with me is my co-writer, co-owner of the blog, Ryan Guarino. Roxy?
Hi, this is Roxy here in my rotating guest spot once again. Thanks for having me on, fellas.
Roxy, great to have you back. You know, maybe when you come on, I should maybe introduce you both separately. That way you can get a grand entrance like Joel.
Well, that would be very generous of you. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah,
we need theme music.
We need entry. Yeah,
you just want this music to be like wrestling.
Yeah, we'll get Roxy some entrance music.
Yeah, our audience would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Glad to have you along, Roxy. We're going to move ahead here. I just want to take a moment to reflect on Mr. Sir, actually, Roger Moore, who passed away this week, unfortunately. At the age of 89, I believe. Of course, well known for his turn in the James Bond films. Live and Let Die, Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, View to a Kill. Octopussy's got to be one of the worst names in film, I swear.
One of those intentionally awkward titles.
Yeah. Anyway, he was a little bit more than James Bond. He also, you know, did such films as The Wild Geese and The Naked Face. And he even had a cameo in one of the Cannonball Run movies. I think it was Cannonball Run 2. Mr. Roger Moore, he was, and of course, also in the television world, he was The Saint, unfortunately remade by Val Kilmer.
Yeah. Oh, throwing shade at Val Kilmer already.
Roger.
That's a record this early in the podcast for us.
Well, I'll have more shade to come, don't worry. Unfortunately, Sir Moore's passing, you know. I guess it was timely. He was 89. He was due, right?
I mean, you got to be the St. James Bond and live to 89. That's a pretty good run. Yeah.
And
He paid his dues.
He did pay his dues. And so, yeah, he's a favorite here. He was a favorite on RetroMovieNerd.com, and he's a favorite of mine. He's probably in some of the more memorable Bond films, you know, basically because at that point, the Bond films became, they almost became a parody of themselves, and these, Moore was in the middle of all of this during that time. He might get a little bad rep because of that, but he's always the number two James Bond in my eyes behind, of course, Mr. Sean Connery.
George Lazenby.
Nah.
Lazenby. Cool. Yeah. In order I go Connery, Moore, Pierce Brosnan, Daniel Craig, Dalton, Lazenby.
Oh, ouch. Ouch, George.
Oh, George.
So, rest in peace, Sir Roger Moore. You will be missed. Onward and upward we move. Come on to the new release section here, guys. We got plenty to talk about this week. Tons of rare and interesting and maybe even forgotten stuff coming out on DVD and Blu-ray this week. Let's start with from Blue Underground, one of our favorite distributors, is what we call the Fu Manchu Twofer, with the Blood of Fu Manchu from 1968 and the Castle of Fu Manchu from 69. Of course, Christopher Lee plays Fu Manchu. And I'm not sure. I haven't seen too many Fu Manchu movies. What about you guys?
Well, I can tell you straight out, Castle of Fu Manchu, MST could not make that entertaining, so that one, it's one to avoid, trust me on that one. I love the Underground, but they were taking a risk with this one.
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to say. Castle of Fu Manchu is infamous because it was on Mystery Science Theater 3000, and the creators of the show, even in the episode itself, characters frequently comment that it's one of the worst movies they've ever had to watch. The robots break down and cry because they just can't get through the movie. So, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware if you're going to pick up a copy of Castle Fu Manchu. If it's too bad for MST, it might be too bad for you.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be picking up any this Fu Manchu set, just due to the fact that I don't really get the character per se for the most part. I'm not quite. Was he evil scientist? He's just an evil villain. I'm not sure what he is exactly. But
total yellow peril. I mean, it has its place in pop history. I've always meant to read some of I think it was Sex Romer, wasn't it, Roxy?
I think that's correct, Joel.
You tend to know your stuff more than me, and like with genre lit. But yeah, like I've always been interested in reading the old Fu Manchu stuff. But I mean, it's definitely he's a character as a product of his time, very much. I mean, we generally don't use those kind of yellow peril orientalist villains anymore.
No, yeah, I mean. I mean, you got to harken back to the 30s with the Charlie Chan movies. I mean, just the hilarity of, you know, a white man, you know, with eye makeup or, you know, yellow face or whatever the case is, you know, just, yeah, you can't get away. This is definitely a product of its time. You can't get away with stuff like that anymore. And
well, Peter Sellers sure tried. I mean, he was like the Charlie Chan parody in Murder by Death, and then I think his last film was a Fu Manchu parody. I think it was The Curse of Fu Manchu or some such thing. But and that was in the 70s and 80s. And I mean, he was parodying the character more than anything else, but it was still Peter Sellers, you know, very respected actor, you know, wearing fake eyelids and what have you, and being like, "Ooh, I'm Asian. It's funny."
Yeah. So, you know, it's more of a curiosity for some people to see how bad movies can get. So, I mean, if that's the way you want to go, yeah, sure, go ahead and pick up this Fu Manchu set. You've been warned.
Yeah, if you want to have, like, a group bet with your friends, whoever lasts the longest watching at Wings, like, that's probably the best use for Castle.
Right. All right, so coming out this week from Intervision Pictures is a two-movie set that starts with Dark Harvest from 1992, and it's doubled up with an anthology movie from 1986 with Vincent Price called Escapes, and that has an interesting note stuck to it.
Yeah, but that's a curious release because I don't know. It doesn't seem like they have any connection, and Dark Harvest seems to be based on the box art, the one they're promoting most heavily. I don't know if Escapes is just, I'm not sure how complete it is. I do know the DVD has an anthology segment of the film that was never on the original release. So I'm not sure how much of this film is coherent, how much of it is put together properly. I really have no knowledge of this film. It seems to be, I mean, this is, for a Vincent Price movie, incredibly obscure.
Well, I actually have seen Escapes.
What?
So
seriously?
No, I really have. Let me.
Oh my god! How is it? What is it like?
Okay, well, wow. I mean, is this how you feel every day? You know,
Joel, you know everything
about everything. Oh my gosh.
Joel, why don't you just waterboard her or something?
Oh my goodness. What's this world coming to? This is getting to be a very un-PC edition of this show. We're joking about torture and yellow face.
Hey, this is one of the ones you're on. That's the only difference between other weeks.
Well, I accept responsibility, and I'm happy to tell you all about Escapes.
Thank you.
As literally anyone who's talked to me for even 30 seconds can tell you, I'm a huge fan of Vincent Price and everything he's done. He's just so wonderful. So I've tried to just see as many of his films as I possibly can. And as you know, he had a very long career. This was definitely, you know, we were kind of coming down the end of the pike here. This was all the way in 1986. And as Vincent Price stuff goes, it's kind of the bottom of the barrel. He makes some perfunctory appearances in the wraparound for this, which is not too creative. It's funny because Vincent was getting very old at this point, and it was really starting to show, but he's seen as a mailman? The opening segment? I mean, the segments are tied together by people who receive a mysterious videotape in the mail, but Vince is the mailman. And, you know, I mean, he was getting to be, you know, sadly a little bit frail looking. And, you know, you wonder, who's allowing that poor man to walk the beat with the mail? He should be at home. Oh, my goodness.
Doesn't the poor man get a pension?
Yeah, I know, right? Like, why isn't he retired?
Well, he works for the United States Postal Service, so I believe you have to work until 85 before you can retire.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, Vince is a jolly postman. There's a mental image for you. But anyway, to make a long story short, Escapes. The segments here were filmed, I think they aired on HBO, they aired on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's a lot of projects that were filmed separately by other people and then sort of strung together in this release with a rather flimsy wraparound device of people receiving this mysterious tape in the mail. And the segments, they're not that memorable. They're all pretty cheap. There's one that's kind of an extended gag. It feels almost like a live-action cartoon about a guy who's fishing, and then he tries to bite an apple, but there's a hook in the apple, and like someone's trying to reel him in on a line.
It's a SpongeBob episode.
I know, right? But they look kind of cheap. They're not that great. I mean, I hate to say it, but even Vince doesn't do much to elevate this effort, and this comes from a hardcore Vincent Price fan. It honestly feels like someone was doing some sort of fan film and invited Vince to participate because he had, like, a free afternoon.
Wow. Okay. So,
I guess that fits in with Intervision's usual lineup. I mean, they tend to go for very bottom-of-the-barrel stuff, just weird Gyrios. I mean, they released Things. They released Dream Stalker. Of course, they released Sledgehammer. A lot of shot-on-video stuff, which Dark Harvest appears to be, except like shot on video scarecrows, so it's looks amazing.
So yeah, maybe that was the link between them, that they were going for like kind of curio stuff. And I love curio stuff. I'm dying to talk about possibly in Michigan on this show. But this stuff just didn't really do it for me. It just wasn't that distinctive or memorable.
Okay. Well, and Dark Harvest, Joel, with the scarecrows, I wonder if it's, and I haven't seen it, but I wonder if it's anything like the movie Scarecrows.
That's not quite high budget, but it's fairly high concept for a Scarecrow film. I mean, it's basically like aliens meet Scarecrows.
Yeah.
So I think Dark Harvest is a more seemingly traditional Scarecrow film, you know, a bunch of morons wandering around farm field getting like slashed by a scythe.
Yeah, you know, that almost sounds like Scarecrows from 1988, which, you know, I'm partial to, of course, when it comes to killer Scarecrow movies.
No, I mean, discounting Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, which is, of course, the best, but totally not like any of the other killer Scarecrow movies. Like, I mean, Scarecrows from 88. That's pretty much everything you want and more. I mean, you get these paramilitary heist crew running away after a huge, like, I forget if it was a bank heist. I mean, total fake out. If the film weren't titled Scarecrows, you'd think it was going to be like a sort of Reservoir Dogs kind of City on Fire kind of thing.
Excuse me. Well, let's move on real quick to this Severin release this week from 1973. It's Blackenstein. Now, I have a copy of Blackenstein on DVD. It's an older release. But definitely, Severin will probably put a lot of bells and whistles on this. That'll be very interesting.
And Severin has a big sale this weekend on their website, I believe, for Memorial Day. It might definitely be worth checking out because I don't know if they're going to be if they're going to put Blackenstein sale being a new release, but. Definitely worth looking at what they've got because their lineup of films is superb.
And for those who are not in the know, Blackenstein is basically taking your monster movie, your Frankenstein movie, and giving it a blaxploitation twist. So very interesting combination. Probably watch it in combination with something like Blackula.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of which, I'm not sure they've announced the date. I think we might have mentioned last week Hudson Horror in October is doing a show at the Alamo Drafthouse of Blackula and Truck Turner.
Yes, I do. Yes, you did mention that last week. Very good to bring that up again.
Yeah, it's nice timing there. Now, Blackenstein I haven't seen yet, but it was directed by William Levy, who did one of my favorite, unfortunately, unreleased films, Skate Town USA.
Skate Town USA is tons of fun. If you love cheesy movies like Xanadu or Can't Stop the Music with the Village People, you will love Skate Town USA. It has literally everything or anyone you could ever want. You have Patrick Swayze in one of his first film roles doing roller disco. You have Chachi from Happy Days. You've got Marsha Brady. You got Billy Barty and Flip Wilson and Ruth Buzzy. You got a magic disco wizard with a giant silver afro. You got a roller skating Uncle Sam, a stereotypical borscht belt comedian, and a hot woman who keeps asking where her pizza is. This movie has everything.
You had me at Billy Barty.
Oh my god, Billy Barty's the best, right? He was in all those canon fairy tale movies too, so check those out if you're a Billy Barty fan.
Yeah, so Blackenstein from Severin, check that out this week. And then we'll get to some Kino Lorber is putting out quite a drop this week, starting with from 1983, and this is a guy we've covered before, Joel, Umberto Lenzi. His contribution to the sword and sorcery genre, Iron Master. I haven't seen this one.
I'm curious to see what Umberto can do with the sword and sorcery genre. I mean, as long as he doesn't kill any animals to make this one, I think it'll be fun.
Oh man, that poor turtle. And I know that's from our first show, guys. When we did Umberto Lenzi, we talked about his cannibal films, and it had the worst possible death scene for a turtle that I've ever seen. I don't want to go into details. If Pete is watching, we might get a cease and desist. Also from Kino Lorber is from a couple from 1988. The first is Hide and Go Shriek, and another one from 88 called Slaughterhouse Rock. Now, again, not familiar with either of these, but Joel, you probably are.
These aren't ones I've seen. Slaughterhouse Rock is got some pretty interesting names attached because it's one of the weird subgenre of rock and roll oriented horror films, and Tony Basil, the singer Mickey.
That's right. When I was looking it up, Tony Basil was in the cast, and I was like, oh, Mickey.
She's a heroic ghost of who. In her living days, was a heavy metal singer, and also I know some of the soundtrack music is by Devo.
Because when you think of heavy metal, you think Devo, right?
You think of Devo. Or, yeah, I have no idea how that happened, especially because I'm sure there were a ton of metal musicians doing soundtracks at the time. I mean, I can't imagine Devo was really all that cheap to hire. I mean, you know, it may have been like 88, but still, I mean, a fairly named band. I mean, obviously they weren't going to be able to afford like a Brian May or someone, but you'd think they would get like, I don't know, Blackie Lawless or someone like that.
Sure. Yeah, good.
This movie honestly sounds pretty awesome. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, look, it's some kind of, rock and roll horror mishmash there. So definitely an interesting selection there from Kino Lorber.
Yeah, they're doing really deep with these really releases. I mean, especially because usually Kino Lorber puts out a lot of, like, genre stuff that's fairly respectable. Like, you know, it may not be something you've heard of, but will usually have some pretty name actors. Like, they put out a lot of stuff with Bronson, with Charlie Bronson. They put out a lot of 70s crime films or, you know, old westerns. So them digging into the slasher movie well, especially for some really obscure ones, is interesting.
Another one that they're putting out from 1989 is a movie titled The Jigsaw Murders, and another one I'm not familiar with.
And yeah, this is one I actually have absolutely no knowledge of. I mean, God, they are getting obscure with this one.
Yeah, this one seems to be more of a like a murder mystery thriller type rather than horror.
Yeah, I think it's one of those films that like in the video store you'd go past the horror section and see like the erotic thriller section with like Poison Ivy and Jade and Fatal Attraction.
And this, Wild Things.
And Wild Things. The film that brought me through puberty.
TMI, Joel. Jeez.
Oh, yeah. Like everyone, dude. Everyone.
Not me.
Even Roxy.
Okay.
I'm gonna
send you guys over to that velvet curtain at the back of the store there. You can check that.
But Jigsaw Murders apparently does have Yaphet Kotto, so it might be worth a look. I don't know. It can't be as bad as Freddy's Dead, right?
What about Vinegar Syndrome? I know you're a big fan of Vinegar Syndrome, you guys. We've got a trio of Vinegar Syndrome releases this week, starting with 1980's The Hearse.
And I haven't gotten a chance to watch my copy yet, but I did pick up a copy of The Hearse from them at Hudson Horror Show last week. It is shipping out this week, but I think for the past couple of weeks at conventions, things like that, they've had it available at their booth. So I'm really excited to take a look at that.
I believe The Hearse is also available on the Shudder streaming service. Just want to give a shout out to Shudder because they're an awesome service. And for $5 a month, I mean, you can't get a better value, you know. So, but last I checked, The Hearse was still on there, so y'all may want to check that out. For those of you who don't own a copy like Joel does.
Oh, yes. So fancy, Joel. Just your top hat.
I've got my monocle of a copy of The Hearse.
I guess we'll follow up The Hearse then with another Vinegar Syndrome release from 1988, The Undertaker, a movie that I'm not familiar with.
And this is one I'm excited to see because this is I don't know if it was a lost film, more of like a forgotten, even, you know, just buried film. But this is a late Joe Spinell performance in the, you know, vein of Maniac. And I'm really curious about this one because he was so good in Maniac.
He was outstanding. Joe is a really underrated actor.
Yeah, and then the final release from Vinegar Syndrome this week from 1985, it's Horror House on Highway 5.
Yeah, this is actually probably best known for a killer wearing a Richard Nixon mask.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know, in researching the titles before the show, I did see that. That's kind of an interesting twist there on that.
Yeah, this is another one I haven't seen, but it seems to be sort of a weird vaguely satirical, vaguely comedic, throw everything at the wall kind of horror film, because there's a mad scientist named Dr. Mabuse as a tribute to Dr. Mabuse. Richard Nixon apparently gets killed apparently in this film, and in the IMDb credits, Richard Nixon is apparently being played by, I'm assuming not the same one, Ronald Reagan is listed as Richard Nixon.
that's quite the gag. That's very appreciative. I appreciate stuff like that. I probably have to check that out because of that now.
It definitely is a very weird looking film. It's not one I've got a chance to see yet, but Vigor's done a lot of those sort of weird, no budget, mad science oriented horror films that lean satire or possibly like occasionally some like avant garde tendencies. I'm thinking of like Frozen Scream was one of those that they put out that feels a bit similar to this one.
All right. Good, very good. So yeah, those are your new releases. Among your new releases this week, there are retro style, of course. You may want to check them out at various online outlets, because mom and pop stores are very hard to find these days. So you may want to discover these online and for yourself.
And also this week, we've got the official release date of the Friday the 13th computer game.
Which could you tell us more about it, Joel?
I got a chance to play it in beta. It's going to be out for PC, and I'm pretty sure this week is also the release of the PS4 and Xbox One copies of it. It's so far entirely multiplayer online. They're talking about adding a single player mode in a future update, but it's basically one person plays Jason, everyone else plays counselors, all who have different stacks, different skills, and you basically have to elude Jason or defeat him. Yeah, you have to escape the area. Fix a car, which is of course immediately broken, being Friday the 13th, to get out. I know a lot of people are streaming it on Twitch right now. I'm sure you'll see like playthroughs on YouTube. My computer's not really a gaming rig, so I did have some issues with the beta, but when I did it, it was really fun. It seems like a really solid, well thought game, and they actually got they actually have some characters show up in the from previous film show up, including Tommy Jarvis, who Tom Matthews actually voices.
I was gonna ask if Tommy shows up in the game, if he's like a playable character.
He actually is. Like, I guess they have him sort of included has a way to. If you fulfill certain objectives, like I think you have to call him in mid-game, like radio him, and someone can actually play him if, someone's been killed by Jason.
Cool. Yeah, hey, since we're on that, are y'all familiar with Friday the 13th video game for the NES?
Oh, my God. Friday the 13th for NES is, I think it's insanely underrated. I totally get why people might not like it, but I think it codified like a lot of tropes that got reused in survival horror games. I might have done that so clumsily, but I'm just a huge fan of the game. I love the style. I love the atmosphere. I mean, it can be a really frustrating, really annoying game at points, but I love the music. I find it a lot of fun. I love Jason's absurd purple and bright, ghastly green color scheme.
No, I played that. I rented it from the local video store, but it was missing the instruction booklet, and so I had absolutely no clue how to play it. And I have, so I mean, this is in the days before the internet, of course, and I've rented Friday the 13th because hey, man, it's Friday the 13th, the video game, and trying it out without the instruction manual was a chore. And I just did not know what I was supposed to do. I did not know how to finish that thing.
Well, you know, I find that the case with a lot of people who played it who haven't, like, gotten to check out the instructions, because a lot of functions of the game you wouldn't really know. It's not totally intuitive, so a lot of the functions of the game design you wouldn't really know unless you went into the manual or now, you know, went to game FAQs or something. Like, you know, a lot of people don't even know, like, when you're in the cabins, like, you can actually switch to a different counselor. You don't have to, in a different cabin, you don't have to actually go physically to that counselor if they're being attacked.
And, FYI, if you're armed only with rocks, you're screwed.
So screwed.
Well, very good. Some good information, though, I think, always. That's why we call you the Atola of pop culture, because you know what the hell you're talking about.
Some business cards.
Let's talk about some girl power this week in movies. Carrie, Firestarter, Hello Mary Lou, Prom Night 2, The Fury, The Craft. Since we're talking Friday the 13th, what about Part 7? These are just some of the movies, you know, that where the female character, either the lead or another character in the film, has some form of telekinesis, you know, or psychic powers to unleash upon the world. And so we're going to talk some girl power this week. And let me ask you guys, what's a good starting point here?
I mean, I guess the place you'd start is, you know, the foundation of these kinds of movies, Carrie, the original 76 Brian De Palma one.
Yeah, and you absolutely can find a review for Carrie on RetroMovieNerd.com. It was my review last week. I went the full Monty. I went 5 stars. It's an awesome film.
It's just phenomenal. And, you know, it seems like every generation, they sort of revive Carrie, like, and do a lot of, around that same time, they'll do a lot of very Carrie-esque horror films, either telekinesis or witchcraft. I mean, a lot of these films blend the two, have both as available in the plot. You know, that sort of fear, fascination, and empowerment dynamic you've got with these films. It just seems like once every generation, it comes back. And even pre-Carrie, like, that stuff existed, but I don't think it ever existed as strongly and as, like, iconic, definitive a form as when Carrie showed up.
Absolutely, yes. If you're talking about, you know, female-centric horror movies, if you're talking about Stephen King adaptations, if you're talking about movies where, you know, some sort of transformation or the acquiring of powers is a metaphor for adolescence and growing up in sexuality. All of these, you know, Carrie is always number one to me when we're talking about films that deal with any of those themes. And it's interesting to see how every time they've tried to redo Carrie, like, what do they focus on? I remember a line in the first remake, the one with Angela Bettis, where the characters of Sue and Tommy are talking about their plan, like, Carrie's going to go to the prom with Tommy, and Tommy says, like, why do I have to do this? This would only work in a Freddie Prinze Jr. movie. But I think it's very funny that they mention that, because those types of movies were really popular then when this first remake came out. Then they did the second remake with Chloe Moretz, and they added cyberbullying to the story, and they added, I think, Carrie looking up stuff on the internet about her powers. So it's interesting to see, like, how Carrie has become a sort of shorthand commentary on our society and our culture. But to me, it'll just never be better than that first adaptation.
Yeah, I think Sissy Spacek really nailed it in that movie, you know, playing just the shy, awkward teenage girl. She had that part down pat. I mean, and then, you know, the whole thing at the end of the movie where, you know, she gets covered in the blood and she, all you can see at that point is just her eyes. I mean, she's totally covered in blood, and her eyes just bug out of her head, and she's just expressing everything with her eyes, and just that's when the shit hits the fan, and that's her only expression through that whole thing. And
you know, it's funny you focus on the eyes, because it reminds me of a essay I was reading on the female prisoner scorpion film. Was talking about Miko Kaji, the way she uses her eyes and that sort of frenzied, you know, that intense glare, and that seems like, and they referred to, and they talked about it in terms of witchcraft, and that seems to be a common like motif with telekinetic movies, with witch stories, let alone movies, like focus on the eyes as almost the central element of power in them.
Yeah, yeah, and I get that, especially after, you know, after you've seen Carrie. I mean, just the all of this pent up. I don't know if it's rage. What is it? But you know, throughout the movie, she's been bullied and harassed, and she gets no respite at school, at home. She's getting it from her domineering religious mother. So I mean, finally, everything just comes to a head, and boom, it's all coming out of her eyes. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I find that really interesting, because that's, God, the eyes are like, are almost the one part of a woman we don't totally commodify yet.
Yes.
Eyes are up here, boys.
But also, Carrie, it makes sense, because, I mean, the whole movie is about how people perceive her, how they view her and react to her. I mean, one of the things I thought, like in the most recent Carrie, the Chloe Grace Moretz one, did, you know, when they did the prom massacre scene, she wasn't quite as covered in blood. I mean, she just looked almost aesthetically covered in blood. It was an art project, and she was moving very gracefully and conducting this. Like, for me, Carrie is like violent outburst of power. She looked like she should be playing Enchantress in Suicide Squad or something, or just like a more traditional witch who's actively using her powers in a very controlled way. You know, every other Carrie, I mean, that I can think of, the sequel, you know, Carrie 2, you know, the Angela Bettis one, it's always been that sort of violent outcropping of this latent energy, all this repression, which is another thing I find it interesting that they've still kept in Carrie, because I almost feel like that sort of very fire and brimstone Christianity isn't really as prevalent in our culture. It almost feels like that very fundamentalist Christianity got savvier. Like, now when we think of, aside from an outlier like the Westboro Baptist Church, we think of like the Duggars or something, stuff that feels very like potlucks and clapping rather than fire and brimstone.
Right, yeah. What do you think, Rux?
I agree with what Joel was saying about the remake and how the finale was very different in that. She seemed to almost be taking joy in the destruction rather than, you know, being swept up in her anger and losing control. So that was very odd.
I agree with that. And I just recently caught that version on television, and it surprised me how it was almost word for word the exact same film as the original.
That's
with some modern twists, of course, with cell phones and the internet and whatnot. But then the prom scene is where it all separates. Everything was just done differently, like you said. You know, it was almost like she was, you know, gracefully conducting the proceedings. Whereas in the original, you know, Carrie is just standing there, stiff as a board, and she just turns her neck 45-degree angle and just glares at something, and it comes crashing down. And then, you know, the scene of I thought the scene outside where she was flipping the car into the gas pumps. We're talking about the remake here. That was, I thought that was overdone, of course. Because in the original, all she does is just give John Travolta's car a look, and it's flipping over and exploding into flames. You know, so yeah, that's just a quick, you know, my take on the Carrie remake. It was just it was almost an unnecessary remake,
which is a shame because it feels more unnecessary than it is. You know, they almost didn't need the religious angle on this one. I mean, I guess I can understand why it's there because, I mean, you've got the element of feminine repression of sexuality. And
how would she not know what her period is?
Yeah, I mean,
they need to come up with a reason for that. So.
I mean, I guess partly the religious element is there because, you know, because they want to continue building the repression idea, which is fine. But I almost feel like now with cell phones, with a million social media websites where bullying occurs, like part of what makes Carrie so beaten down is that she never gets any respite from her pain. And now that's like you don't need parents for that anymore, because your bullies basically can get you on any platform that you're on. And no one's actively going to remove themselves from a social media platform just because of that.
It's sad, you know. It's funny whenever I'm like, I work for local government. We always have this thing at Workers' Memorial Day, which is to celebrate people who have the memory of people who have died in work-related accidents, like railroads, electrical, engineering, things like that. And the people there, they always say, well, I'm honored to have this ceremony to honor the memory of these people, but I hope the day comes where we never have to have another one, as in where no more people would die. And I love Carrie, but I hope we come to a day where the story is no longer relevant anymore and kids aren't, you know, dying from being bullied. And, you know, again, based on my personal experience, sometimes people just get pushed too hard.
I think we can all agree on that take, Roxy, you know. You know, strong words there. I appreciate that.
Yeah, sorry to have cast a black cloud over the proceedings
Oh, yeah, you really ruined the lighthearted, whimsical fun of Carrie.
Woo-hoo!
That's right. You know, one of the stars of Carrie was Amy Irving, and that wasn't her first bout with a telekinetic character. Because she would be in 1978's The Fury, where she is actually the one in possession of telekinesis this time.
The Fury, the search for more money.
I thought that was Spaceballs 2.
Well, it could be The Fury as well. Yeah, I mean, it's weird that, like, I'm surprised Brian De Palma actually signed on to do another telekinesis film, which is to say it's not a quality film because the cast is just phenomenal. I mean, the John Williams score is amazing. You know, I feel like this one, unfortunately, Amy Irving doesn't get as much to do because you know, she gets to discover her powers, but she's kind of just the audience surrogate, the introductory character, almost like I think the modern equivalent I always think of in terms of useless audience surrogates is Ellen Page in Inception.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Where they don't get anything to do, anything, because the plot is sort of mostly about the people around her. I mean, she does get an awesome moment in the finale, but, you know, everything complicated that's happening is sort of almost outside her understanding, aside from her own powers.
Yeah, I'm not one for spoilers, Joel. I don't like to hide spoilers. This movie's from 1978, so it's been almost 40 years. And so, if anyone's interested, Amy Irving makes a guy explode.
Oh, come on! See, you're just like the guys who did the trailer for Scanners.
You're giving away the head explosion in the trailer?
Giving away which I have to say, probably the only part of Scanners that I could possibly care about.
Doesn't that happen in like the first like 15 minutes of the movie? Yeah, so you know, when that happens, you're like, all right, time to turn it off or go home, you know?
My money.
The best part just happened. I don't need to see this.
Fury should get to explode someone at the end of the movie. So at least she does get a cool moment, but like so much of the plot machinations are about the people around her, and she's just sort of the innocent one. But I mean, you know, it's got Kirk Douglas, it's got John Cassavetes, it's got Charles Durning. It's really worth a watch.
Okay. And so, you know, moving along here, unless Roxy, do you have a take on the Fury at all?
I haven't actually seen the Fury, but I'm very interested too, being a Carrie fan and, you know, curious to see how Amy Irving handles the other side of the situation.
Very good. So let's move on to a movie like Firestarter with Drew Barrymore this time as the pyrokinesis.
And we'd actually just watched that on the past day. I mean, I had seen it before, but it had been years, so I finally got to break out the Scream Factory Blu-ray I picked up of it. And, it's actually better than I remember, even better. Really, really fantastic. I mean, you know, that Stephen King element of, you've got magical powers, but they come from some kind of spooky government, spooky government contrivance, you know, to fight the Cold War. You know, Firestarter is a bit different from a lot of movies we're talking about because it's an actual little girl rather than an adolescent teenage girl, or even in some of them, you know, a college age girl. But there's still that same fascination, fear of female sexuality. I mean, there's a big conversation between all these, you know, vaguely CIA operatives about what's going to happen when Drew Barrymore becomes a teenager, when her pituitary gland, which is the source of her powers, becomes like the strongest element of her body. I mean, they're literally saying in fantastic terms, like, what the hell is going to happen when she becomes a woman? It'd be a disaster. She's going to destroy the world with her womanly powers. Well, and there's a weird element of it that's very, speaking of Charles Durning, very Charles Durning in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. George C. Scott is an assassin who has a weird sort of pedophilic death fetish fascination with Drew Barrymore.
It's really
uncomfortable. So. plus, I mean, it's also not he's got that eye patch.
Oh, the eye patch! Oh my God! I mean, poor George C. Scott, who, don't get me wrong, has like is as fearless an actor as you're ever going to find. That he's got to have this, you know, messed up eye, wear this eye patch, be totally skeevy all the time.
And
like, he's a phenomenal villain, though.
He is. Oh my God. I mean, it's, you're fascinated and at the same time you're horribly revolted. I would like flinch every time he would like get close to the little girl or touch her. And it's almost like, you know, he talks about how he wants her power, how he wants to take it from her when she crosses over into the next world. So it's almost sort of like God worship. It's also kind of like a I want to be you thing, because he wants to take her powers when he crosses over into the afterlife. He talks about how he wants to kill her at her moment of extreme happiness and then kill himself. But like, in the end, I hope this isn't the spoiler, buddy, she kills him, and he yells out, I love you, and I remember thinking, like, what? Like, I was just so gobsmacked by that, and I mean, he's a wonderful actor, and to his credit, you know, it's, he gives a performance that's so terrifying, it's really hard to pin it down. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and that whole dialogue at the end for him there is just I can't believe that considering the quality of the rest of the film, that would probably be one of the lower points for me anyway, one of the lower points of the movie. And I can't believe that they didn't decide to rewrite something like that, because it just came off awkward to me.
It is awkward, and at the same time, it fascinates me because it's almost like a more boldly stated version of what all of these other scientists are, scientists and like government agents are doing. I mean, they're basically, if you want to put it in like some kind of political social context metaphor, they're taking away the parental rights of her parents. They're determining what she, they're studying her and determining what she should do with her own body while removing her agency. I mean, it's a weirdly feminist movie, which I guess is not surprising from the guy who wrote Carrie. I mean, Stephen King, for when he does have a female protagonist or at least focal antagonist, he's usually pretty good about representing their dilemma in the context of a society around them. So it's interesting to see the George C. Scott character like in that context where he's just sort of stating what they're expressing through science or through weaponizing her. Like, he's just saying, I mean, I guess he's sort of the equivalent almost of the mom and Carrie, a seeming religious fanatic who wants to control a young woman's body. But it's somehow much creepier and much more different than that.
Yeah, I love George C. Scott like the next person does, but when you rewatch this now and the way stuff like this just makes the news now, in this age of the internet, I can see this turn from Scott, going down in the annals of movie history as one of the more unintentionally uncomfortable or some might even say hilarious roles.
And I'm not even sure it's unintentional discomfort. I mean, George C. Scott seems like the kind of actor who might have thrived a little bit on prodding his audience. So, I mean, we're not as we're more sensitive to this kind of stuff now. I mean, I'm sure we were then. I mean, the 80s was the era where people are first talking about serial killers, where America's Most Wanted shows up, where Stranger Danger is being taught widely. So it's not a surprise that Stephen King was, like, tapping into that. It also might have been cocaine on his part.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Cocaine. It's a hell of a drug.
It is a hell of a drug.
It did give us everyone's favorite scene from It.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Do we have to talk about that?
No. We'll save that for another show, Roxy.
We'll save that for an even more uncomfortable show.
Let's get into... Well, let's see. This... avenue, telekinesis, girl power, whatever have you, is not just relegated to the big screen, because the small screen television also took advantage of it, especially in the late 70s, during the era when made-for-TV movies were considered big events. Every weekend was like the ABC movie of the week, the NBC movie of the week. An era where, the networks would dish out just a few more dollars to, provide two extra hours of entertainment for people on the weekend. And one of the movies that stands out from that era, considering this topic, is a movie called The Initiation of Sarah.
Yeah, and I just got a chance to watch that for the first time. I thought it was a really good little film. I mean, for those listeners of ours who don't have much experience with made-for-TV movies, generally speaking, there's a lot of character development and a few minor things happening. And the last about 15 to 20 minutes of any of these films is where, like, all the big stuff happens. it's partly, but partly budget and partly just they want to keep you on the hook so you'll stay in. So you'll watch through the commercials. But no, initially from the start, I mean, there were a lot of Kari clones coming after me. Of course, the Fury. There was the Spell from 77, which I haven't seen. Initiation of Sarah is a really interesting variation on that theme. Like, you know, some of it is very outdated. Like, you know, the whole I want to join the good sorority theme. Like, we still have sororities apparently. But that it's sort of a look into a version of college that doesn't really exist anymore. But I mean, it's a really interesting moment to set that sort of telekinetic plot line in, because I mean, you've got Sarah leaving for college with her sister. Sarah's adopted. Her sister is doesn't have any powers. She's much more socially acceptable. Much more, she's alone, kicks into the sorority, and Sarah ends up veers into Revenge of the Nerds territory. Sarah joins the like smart grumpy girl sorority.
What were they called in Revenge of the Nerds? The Beta Moos or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah. Now, so she joins them, sort of leads them to like, you know, greater like sense of self. And one of the interesting factors is that her the house mother, who is really into witchcraft, and is strongly implied that she might be Sarah's actual mother, but that's never really said, is played by Shelley Winters, who is just awesome in this. I mean, she's always awesome. You know, just fun, weird, scheming, manipulative, strange. She's just a really cool performance. And, you know, I think it's a nice link to an almost similar genre film about female-oriented horror, the psychobiddy genre that Whatever Happened to Baby Jane coined, because Shelley Winters was in a number of films like that, including What's the Matter with Helen, which Scream Factory released.
Yeah.
Great film.
Yeah, that is an awesome film. Yeah, Initiation of Sarah, an interesting case, because she's definitely more controlled in her powers. I would say that this film seems to be very strongly if covertly a lesbian film.
Ah, there it is. Yes, you know, that's you know, a lot of these films, that might be the underlying link on a lot of these films, is that there might be some I don't want to say latent, but it's there's some implied, you know, lesbianism in a lot of these.
Yeah, I mean, they're always strongly female-oriented. You know, it's a female outsider. She's usually got, like, one or more also outside female friends, or sometimes, like, a benefactor female character like Amy Irving and Carrie, that takes an unusual interest in her. I mean, it doesn't – that doesn't always mean, you know, they in lesbian – undertones, but Initiation of Sarah, I think, is very strongly in that realm. I mean, a friend of hers from the sorority is very, very clearly in love with her. You know, their whole sorority, you know, being the smart girls, they dress very, very practically, almost like what you describe as not quite stereotypical, but sort of coded lesbian wardrobe. Like, there's a lot of pants, a lot of army jackets. Just it feels like if you went into a lesbian bar and like Stonewall or something back in the 70s, these are like the kind of women you would see.
Yeah. So we got since we're in the TV movie realm here, Joel. Let's bring in Midnight Offerings from 1981, I believe. And
love Midnight Offerings.
This is more witchcraft more than anything else. We'll step out of the telekinetic realm for a moment and go into witchcraft with this one.
Although conveniently for the special effects budget, a lot of witchcraft looks strangely like telekinesis.
That's true.
Midnight Offerings, there's an interesting little bit of stunt casting here because it's Melissa Sue Anderson, who I believe was in Little House on the Prairie.
And I remember her from Flash Gordon as well, the big screen adaptation.
So Melissa Sue Anderson is from Little House, and Mary Beth McDonough, Melissa Sue, I should say, is the antagonist of this, and Mary Beth McDonough is the lead girl, and she was on The Walling, so they sort of advertised it as Little House versus The Walling Showdown.
I probably would have watched it based on that if I had known it existed when I was, 7 years old.
Yeah, what's interesting here is that it's so basically the plot is Robin Mary Beth's character moves to a new town. She's sort of a budding witch, but her mom and witch powers are inherited in this and seem very strongly feminine. It's implied that pretty much only women have it. So of course. Melissa Sue Anderson, Vivian, is the bigger on campus because she's used her witchcraft for that. She's a much stronger, much more experienced witch than Robin because she's been spent her life studying. Her mom is a witch. She knows, although it's clear very early on, there's a big schism between them. Robin, her mom died presumably years ago. She doesn't really know much about what she is. Her dad and her keep moving because her powers keep violently bursting out at the worst times, very Carrie-like. And the whole film develops into this big showdown between them. I mean, what I find, I love just that there's such domestic trappings for this witch showdown. I mean, they have big battles in the shop room of their high school. There's a lot of walking on beaches. There's a lot of going to school. I mean, it's just like normal teenagers who happen to be witches, which is a style of thing that I think it was weirdly prescient. If you turn on MTV right now and Teen Wolf or something like that was on, it'd be basically the same thing. And what's interesting, but there's the strong domesticity with the witchcraft, which is never considered a bad thing. Maybe it's sort of inhibiting, Melissa Sue Anderson seems to feel it is, she's dying to get out of her town and be an important major person using these powers. And of course it's implied that's not good because she's using these powers to harm people, but it's not implied that these powers are inherently bad. The interesting thing is that when Robin needs someone to talk to who actually has some background here, she finds an older psychic played by Marion Ross of Happy Days. Cool. I mean, if you could imagine a less threatening woman to be an expert in witchcraft, I just find that really interesting because because I've been talking about that whole fear fascination dynamic with feminine power that these films illustrate. Here it's a case where you have three women who are all engaged in this, who are all from the most clean cut, squeaky clean white bread shows you could possibly imagine.
You gave them a twist like that. Yeah, I do have to correct myself on one thing, though, Joel. And I said that Melissa Sue Anderson was in Flash Gordon. I was wrong. That is Melody. And I used to get those two mixed up. Yes, that's true. So my apologies to both Melissa Sue and Melody Anderson because I got y'all mixed up.
If they're listening, I'm sure we're going to get a libel suit soon.
I'm sure they're not listening. Anyway,
so. Just a quick thing, Emory. I'm just really fascinated by Midnight Offerings, the way it sort of recontextualizes normal things in as supernatural and yet not. The big finale takes place in front of a bonfire that's scheduled for like a homecoming celebration. It's like, which I've always fascinated me because we used to do that when I was in high school. I'm not sure they do anymore. It might be like a liability, but it's just the idea that like you could celebrate something as mundane as a high school homecoming and football game and have like a, almost something akin to a pagan ritual to do it. And no one seems to notice that this is weird. I just love that element of this movie.
Yeah. You know, it's almost, since we're on that topic, we'll jump ahead a little bit because it's almost similar to, from 1996, the movie, The Craft. Who do we have in The Craft, Joel? We've got, Nev Campbell, Fairuza Balk, Robin Tunney. I don't remember the name of the fourth girl. Anyway, but you know, most of our listeners are probably familiar with The Craft, and of course, it's a group of teenage girls who practice witchcraft to try and get advantages throughout their teenage lives. You know, I recently reviewed that movie as well for RetroMovieNerd.com. The thing I didn't much care for in this movie was the whole Beverly Hills 90210 aspect of it with the high school drama, you know. The witchcraft stuff itself was very interesting, but everything leading up to it with the whole teen drama and stuff like that kind of turned me off the whole thing.
Yeah, I almost wonder if, like, The Craft wasn't sort of trying to parody or satirize that kind of stuff, like, because I mean, you're talking, like you said, 90210. I mean, this was an era of where teen dramas were huge, and I mean, not that like that's unusual in the history of television, but I almost think that like at the turn of the 80s, when you get 90210 and 21 Jump Street, like that's when this becomes almost a perennial trope. I mean, it wouldn't be that long until Dawson's Creek premiered, and it almost seemed like they were trying to, like, use that for, of course, there's my so-called life around the same time. Party of Five has that. Like, it almost seems like they're trying to use that format to say something, but I think they sort of fall into those tropes a bit too heavily.
Not the target audience for this film, because I really felt that it would have appealed more to actual, you know, teenage girls, this type of film, than it would to teenage or 20-something guys. I just didn't get the teenage drama thing, because that sort of thing, even when I was coming up through high school and whatnot, I avoided all of that. You know, I wasn't wrapped up in myself and things of that nature. So, you know, it didn't resonate with me.
Yeah, there's part of me that's always wondered about The Craft if they're trying to say something like about the way those teen dramas institute like really weird priorities for girls. Like, and you know, that's not just for women, of course. I mean, pop culture institutes weird priorities for everyone, but The Craft seems to be like trying to put that up against like what if you have like taking those like very stereotypical tropes of high school, like, and it's sort of like Midnight Offerings is doing, but I think Midnight Offerings did it much more subtly, if there was some kind of like cheat code, what would that look like? I mean, I guess the problem there for me is assuming that high school is like a separate society.
Yeah, there's a thing in this film where Robin Tunney, she's dating, she goes on a date with, I believe, Skeet Ulrich, and he wants to, you know, make out with her, but she turns him down, and then he starts spreading a nasty rumor around school about her. So when it comes time to cast her spells, she still insists on casting, I guess, a love spell over this big jerk who treated her bad. Why would she still want to? Why would she still want to have anything to do with the guy after that? You know what I mean?
Don't ask me.
Yeah, I mean, so that's part of that whole teenage drama aspect of that film that you know, I called into question.
Personally, I've never...
No, go on, Roxy, go.
Personally, I've never found a lot of that teen drama stuff in movies to be that realistic. If it resembles reality at all, it's very exaggerated. Yeah. That's all I had to say.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've never been a huge fan of The Craft, which is weird because, I mean, I'm the one suggested this topic, and I love these girl supernatural horror films. I think the thing with me for the craft, it almost more than these other films we're talking about, resembles, you know, a Danger of Fame narrative more than anything. Like, it's sort of like, it's something you expect go into expecting to be like an empowerment film, but it's all about don't extend beyond your boundaries because then you'll turn into a jerk and, yeah, you know, lose all your friends. Like, which is what they turned the Gem the Holograms film into, where Gem was...
What a joke.
Oh, my goodness.
We're big Gem fans over here, Chris. You're just going to have to get used to it.
Oh, man.
Which is actually kind of similar to the kind of films we're talking about, because it's about a normal girl with, you know, a secret identity, a secret power that helps her function in the real world beyond what just as a normal girl she could have done. And yet, like, the whole thing, there's always that tension between using your powers and or just being like yourself, to what extent they comprise yourself, to what extent they take away from what you could accomplish otherwise. I mean, you know, so, especially in the more recent Gem comics, like, that's I think in a lot of like films like The Initiation of Sarah, where the powers are a bit more controlled, Midnight Offerings is big about that. That element is there. The Craft is basically just like, stay in your place. If it's on the side of anything, it's on like the side of teamwork and friendship, which now we're getting into Power Rangers territory.
Yeah. So we'll lump it in The Craft with this. It's definitely, I guess, a different vibe than the movies we've talked about at this point. What I want to do right now, guys, is we're going to take a break. We're going to return on the other side with a couple of more films on the topic of girl power. Then we'll get into our triple bill spill before we close the show. So let's step away for just a moment, and we will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all these shows, plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
And welcome back to Go Home in the Box, where we are talking about girl power in our genre films. We left off talking about the craft and the idea of witchcraft. There's plenty of other films in this genre to discuss. One of which, what we were talking about while we were on a break, that Roxy, you're a big fan of, is a movie from 1984 called Poison of the Fairies.
Yeah, Poison of the Fairies. This is a Mexican movie from 1994. This is another movie like The Craft where friendship and witchcraft kind of go hand in hand. And if you like movies about corrupted kids like The Bad Seed or Mikey, I highly suggest that you check it out. It has a very sort of 70s look to it, even though it was made in 1984. But it's about a little girl who is kind of growing up in bizarre fairy tale circumstances. She lives all alone in a big house with her grandmother and the grandmother's maid. And she's so obsessed with the idea of fairy tales and witches that she decides she wants to be a witch. And she's always acting out these little rituals and spells. And a new girl comes to her school. Her family's pretty well off, but they seem to neglect her emotionally. And she just seems to be searching for anyone to befriend her. So she falls in with this girl, Veronica, the one who's living with her grandmother. And Veronica tells her that she really is a witch. And by, you know, manipulating certain events. And it's an interesting film because, you know, the girl ends up really believing what Veronica tells her because of a series of coincidences and misunderstandings. I think Adam is really about the power of suggestion and how, if people want to believe something, something is true, then they will. It's a film that's about witchcraft where nothing supernatural actually happens. And it has a twist ending that will definitely take you by surprise. Oh, so
very interesting. Yeah, I was not familiar with this movie before you mentioned it. So it seems like something in the vein of, I guess it's similar to, I guess, Heavenly Creatures.
Definitely, the tone is very similar to Heavenly Creatures. And the film is not afraid to go to some dark places, which is weird because it starts off, kind of looking somewhat whimsical, like the kids are dressed like they're little porcelain dolls and everything, and just, you know, there's a lot of surprises, so
very
check
good.
It out.
Okay. Now, Joel, another movie that we need to discuss is the film Ginger Snaps. Yeah, this is one that we had forgotten about in our pre-show discussion, but I think it fits in this vein.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, Ginger Snaps, like we've been talking about these films as metaphors for, you know, burgeoning sexuality as puberty. I mean, Ginger Snaps, of course, makes the connection between werewolves and female adolescents with, with female puberty, with periods, which is something that, you know, had been done before in some mythological context and occasional horror stories. Like, I know Alan Moore played with that in an issue of his Swamp Thing run. But it's something that, you know, aside from The Howling, which was about adults, I'm surprised more movies didn't really touch on by that point, because it seems an obvious connection. And you were saying about the craft, it takes a lot of the tropes of teenage movies, of teenage drama stories, but I think it uses them better. It sort of criticizes those stories, because the whole focus really is on the sisters and the strength of their relationship and how it falls out because Ginger's trying to live those stories.
Yeah, and you know, Ginger Snaps is one that got a lot of notice. I see. I'm a native Canadian, and so Ginger Snaps was a Canadian-made film, so it got a little bit more discussion on the home front than it did down here stateside.
Yeah, I think the cult of it in America, I think, is strong, but it's never quite gotten the recognition I think it really deserved. I know there was some controversy around when it came out because it was being produced 1999, right when Columbine had, I believe, another high school shooting around that time, like right when it was in production, and actually lost some funding due to that. And I wonder how much of that hurt, like how much of an audience it could reach.
It probably hurt the promotion somewhat. I mean, you know, after an event like that, it's probably something you want to probably want to hold back on, I would imagine.
I mean, it's like, you know, big events like that horrified the public, for a little while until people, you know, until the surprise and shock passes. Generally speaking, there's a bit of self-censorship going on with the media sources. I mean, it happened a bit after Sandy Hook, definitely happened after 9/11. And of course, it did happen in many places after Columbine. So, I'm surprised it affected a werewolf film, but it is a high school film full of violence. So, on one level, I'm not surprised.
Well, you mentioned werewolf film. I guess the next logical progression here is to talk about a movie like The Company of Wolves. Am I right?
That is correct, Chris. Yeah, I was, Joel and I were talking about this movie, not just because of today's topic, but, you know, we were talking about it at Hudson Horror, and people had some really fond memories of this one. Does it get brought up as often as you would think? Because this film really, like, was ahead of its time. I mean, I read a lot of fantasy fiction, and the whole Little Red Riding Hood but with werewolves thing has been absolutely done to death. But this one, this one was the very first one from a wonderful author, Angela Carter. Check her out sometime. She did a great collection of horror fairy tales called The Bloody Chamber. She writes a lot of very weird fantasy horror fiction. She's amazing. But, Company of Wolves, very cool. I think Canon distributed the film in the U.S., which is very interesting. It's a really arty film for them. You know, Neil Jordan, who directed The Crying Game, directed this. And the film, the atmosphere is really like a fever dream. That's the most common description that I've heard of it. And yes, there is a ton of imagery going around, and some of it is pretty obvious, like, oh, the white flower is turning red. I wonder what that means. And all of that. Is there a little bit too much of that? Well, they could have cut back a little bit. And but, I mean, I think that the point of the film is not necessarily a story so much as trying to convey a mood and trying to convey the idea of... you know, storytelling, metaphor, fairy tales, as a metaphor for adolescence, because stories are frequently told throughout the film itself. In a way, it's almost an anthology film based around this theme. So that's pretty interesting. It's got a great cast. Angela Lansbury is Grandma. David Warner is Red Riding Hood's father. And Sarah Patterson, who would star in another canon fairy tale movie, the canon movie tale Snow White, who sadly hasn't done that much other stuff, because she was really good, and, you know, she was 12 years old when she starred in this movie, and I really hope some of it went over her head, because it's pretty extreme stuff, but really impressive gore and creature effects, especially at this time for a movie distributed by Canon, work of a great author, great visual style, fun cameo from Terrence Stamp. I say... check it out. Just be prepared to not be there for the story, but to be there for the experience.
Yeah, we didn't get to a few of these on our little journey through canon, Joel.
No, I mean, God, the canon put out so much stuff, and so much of it was not like a typical canon film. That how could you get to it all, even with the 3 hours we spent talking about canon?
I know, I mean, there was we only scratched the surface with canon, but yeah, these are probably Company of Wolves is definitely, you know, one of their more artsy fartsy attempts, you know what I mean? Well, let's step back into the telekinesis realm here for a minute, because there's still a another movie or two I want to touch on. And we'll go into one of the more mainstream, more well-known horror realms here with the Friday the 13th series. But we'll jump to part 7. The New Blood? Is that right? Yeah, that's right. Friday the 13th, part 7,
correct,
The New Blood. That was, as you mentioned, Joel, before the show, this is... basically Carrie versus Jason.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they were actually planning to like try to cross over, because one of the early plans for part 7 was to do the Jason Freddy crossover, but Friday the 13th was still owned by Paramount at the time, and they just couldn't work a deal. That didn't happen until New Line owned the series. So I don't know if they actually were going to try to make a legit crossover, just figured we could put a psychic girl in here and not have to share profits, which was probably the case. Friday 13-7 is a really, you know, people have mixed feelings on it. I mean, it's, you know, the first Kane Hodder Jason, so people love that. The makeup is great. A lot of it got, you know, absolutely savaged by the MPAA for cuts. But I think a lot of people just don't know what to make of it, and I'm really not sure either.
Yeah, there are like, many times that franchise really jumped the shark, I guess you could say.
I mean, it's really hard to... One of the interesting things for Friday the 13th is that Friday the 13th inherently, especially when you watch the earlier ones, is a series about motherhood, and it's a series about grief. Part 7 has a bit of that, but it's not really fully there. It just seems kind of gimmicky rather than, you know, as fun a film as it is. Like, I don't know exactly what they got out of putting Jason up against a telekinetic girl.
Yeah, I just... you know, I'm turning on the whole franchise itself, because, you know, the first three movies, I guess, being the strongest, and then after that, it just was just one make after another to try and revive the franchise. I mean, you had Jason supposedly dying in the fourth one, and then in the fifth one you had someone completely different playing the killer. And then in the sixth one, we were, at one point, I believe we were supposed to get Tommy becoming Jason. That went out the window. And then, and with seven, I mean, you bring in a telekinetic to battle Jason Voorhees. I mean, like you said, it's really gimmicky. And jumping the shark and just, what were they going? I think they were going for more of an action film rather than your typical slasher.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. And honestly, I'm cool with Friday the 13th being like gimmicky because fundamentally to me, like, the first two are the Friday the 13th story. Everything else is just kind of, Jason is just sort of, it's like a Yojimbo thing or Zatoichi or any or the man with no name. Jason's just kind of an insert character that you can use to tell like another story. Yeah. Just in the, so like, you know, four, five, and six are kind of the Tommy Jarvis story. And the weird thing is, like, five, even though people hate it, I think people are sort of coming around on it a bit. You know, by being about a grieving father rather than Jason that time around, it had more common with the first two than I think a lot of people realized initially. I think 4, 5, and 6 are interesting for just being the continuation of that Tommy Jarvis story, and I think they're trying to suggest like that Jason was more almost like an idea, like a revenant kind of vengeance spirit thing, but that they actually ended up doing in part 9. But, you know, I think especially once you got Tommy, you got Tom Matthews as Tommy Jarvis, it wasn't really necessary to do that stuff anymore because he just made the character, it made sense for him to be the, like, arch rival of Jason at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to, in defense of the whole thing, you have to come up with fresh ideas for a franchise like that. Otherwise, you're just getting Jason kills teenagers over and over and over. And, eventually that gets tiring.
And it's not a franchise like Nightmare on Elm Street where you have sort of a license to do a million different things because the concept is stretchable. Friday the 13th, I mean, it's just a guy in the woods, however, you know, invulnerable he is. He's just a guy in the woods killing kids. You know, it's not like, Nightmare on Elm Street level, like, we can mess with this concept because it's inherently supernatural. So, I don't know. I think Part 7, as weird as it is kind of a welcome addition. I'm not sure it's really... Well, you know, I was going to say, I'm not sure it's really doing much in terms of, like, telekinetic girl stories, but, yeah, there's that really interesting, like, subplot about her doctor, Dr. Cruz, played by Terry Kaiser, I think, Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's. And he's under the guise of psychiatry, like, helping her with psychiatry, is trying to develop and manipulate her powers, which is, you know, very Firestarter. Only he's not the government; he's just a doctor, which I find really interesting that he has the balls to like do that kind of evil madman plot when he's just like a guy in a sweater.
Yeah, if Dr. Phil had been around back then, I probably would have compared Terry Kaiser's character to Dr. Phil.
Oh my God, that's a brilliant idea, Dr. Phil manipulating Carrie. Oh, that's a move. Every time I see that smug jerk's face, oh, no, perfect villain.
Yeah,
perfect for a movie film.
Are you sure you don't mean Dr. Oz, Joel?
I hate him too.
They're all quacks.
They are next week on this show. Joel's personal shit list of TV doctors.
The only doctor I trust is Dr. Giggles.
Dr. Giggles.
Larry Drake was an inspiration to us all.
What about, okay, so there's another franchise that we got to hit on with this, and that's the Prom Night franchise, specifically Prom Night 2, Hello Mary Lou, and I don't even think it's related, you know, to the original Prom Night with Jamie Lee Curtis, but it's got the Prom Night tag stuck.
Not at all.
It's got Prom Night tag stuck on it, so it's part of the it's part of the franchise. So, but this is another interesting one here.
Yeah, I'm a huge Prom Night 2 fan, and this is one of the, you know, I want mostly a set of these kinds of films we're talking about, or at least something connected, is the Possession film, which is not something we've really been talking about much because I don't think it fully connects, because it's a lot about the fact that it's like usually a girl being possessed or taken, like in, say, Poltergeist or something like that, sometimes matters, but usually it's just, it doesn't. Here, like, our lead being possessed by Mary Lou, like, she's, like, we've got a lead girl who's, she's pretty normal, but she's from a repressed family. I mean, it's like if Carrie grew up to be actually pretty normal if her dad was still around. Like, but she's clearly, like, holding back a bit. Like, she's, like, they combined the sort of repression element with her just being too nice for her own, like, that personality type. And so you've got two, so Mary, her being possessed by Mary Lou, it's like two different elements. Her being able to be fully sexual and fully, you know, embrace that part of her. And also her being able to, like, her being able to elude the part of her that needs to be, like, absolutely perfect all the time. Like, the part of her that is needs to be the, needs to be the best friend to everyone, that needs to be the responsible one. I mean, that, yeah, everyone knows someone like that, or was someone like that, especially in high school when, you know, you've always got, like, in every group of friends, one person who feels the need to watch over everyone else because they recognize that the other ones in their group are too stupid to do it themselves.
Yeah, this is, and also I want to add that this movie has been stuck with the Chris Jordan approved tag of batshit insane.
It's so insane.
No kidding.
Yeah, the only other movie we've talked about on any prior show that has that tag, of course, was From Beyond. But I'm going to expand that with some of these other movies we talk about. But yeah, Hello Mary Lou follows up From Beyond as batshit insane. Hashtag.
Oh, it's good. It's good company. Now, Rusty, what was your favorite scene from Hello, Mary Lou?
Oh, wow. There are a lot of things in this movie that really stand out to me. One character I would have loved to see more of is the main character, Vicky, her friend Jess, who is Mary Lou's first victim in the 80s story, the story proper of the film, because she touches Mary Lou's crown and then Mary Lou kills her. But Jess was, you know, like, really depressed because she thought she was pregnant. And, like, I thought that this was, you know, really interesting. We were being set up for some kind of commentary on sexuality because the film is preoccupied with female sexuality, but we don't ever really go back to that. And Jess seems like a really nice person and an interesting character, but unfortunately we don't get to know her very well. So I'll single that out. There's some crazy imagery in this movie, and, some weird subtext that would really give Company of Wolves a run for its money, if you know what I mean. There's the whole weird thing when the character, Vicky, the main character, gets possessed by Mary Lou, and she starts coming on to her dad, and her dad seems like he's kind of into that.
Yeah, I forgot about that part. That is another one.
You purged it from your mind. We're doing that a lot on this show, just bringing up stuff Chris would have liked to forget. But to me, the indelible image from this film, one that will stick with anyone, is the weird, like, rocking horse, carousel horse in Vicky's room.
I didn't know you were going to say the rocking horse scene.
That thing is demented! Oh my god, I've never seen anything quite like it in a horror movie, I have to say. But, like, it starts out, you know, like, Joel's mom has a horse like that at her house. Like, oh, you know, what a cute horse. That's nice. Then it gets possessed and like the eyes are real and the eyes are rolling around in its head and its mouth is drooling and everything. And like, what the hell? What's the significance of this? I mean, I think it's a whole subverted innocence thing. But beyond that, I just don't know. All I know is I'm horrified.
Well, our horse is also typically like seen as sort of sexual, like expression of young woman sexuality, like a fascination of horses with unicorns, aren't they? Like sort of.
Oh yeah, you know, that's so true. Because even talk about how girls get obsessed with horses and then they grow out of that and then they go after boys. It's funny. I have to say, I did have a brief period of horseback riding lessons when I was a kid, and I don't know about the whole female sexuality thing with that, but that does come up a lot in art.
Oh.
It seems like it could be a subjective experience, but yeah, I think that might be what that represents. And it's funny that they touch on that in Firestarter too, because she loves to ride horses.
Oh, you're right.
She's that powerful black male horse, and his name is Necromancer. And you know, we've got some heavy symbolism there as well, don't we?
We're linking, yes.
Especially because she's like, what a pretty horse. What's her name? And George C. Scott says, oh, that's a boy horse. And his name's Necromancer,
I'm cracking up, but I mean, just these common threads that are finally coming together are just, I don't know what to say about it, you know?
it's a weird thing. It's a weird time. This, I guess it was inevitable we were going to have to bring up the
next talk. We've taken a turn here at Go Home in the Box. I don't want to really slap an X rating on it yet, though. Maybe PG.
No, we're not quite X rated. We're more just uncomfortable, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
This is life, viewers. For all of our friends coming to listen to us talk about things like canon after listening to wrestling podcast and watching wrestling pay per views. I am so sorry. But
I'm sorry too. I guess I'm a troublemaker because I seem to keep bringing this stuff up.
Well,
so I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm the one who just did this topic.
Yeah, it's your fault. Let's blame him.
No, I actually appreciate the different point of view because it actually brings in a perspective. I'm not sure if Joel and I would have touched on stuff like that, Roxy. But you know, we appreciate the different viewpoints that you bring to the table.
Well, thank you.
Of course.
Go ahead, Joel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh, man, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I'm fascinated by Prominent Two because there's, I think, two of course, the fact that Mary Lou, you know, is a ghost from the 50s and that, like, immediately she, and of course, the 50s, culturally, it's like our shorthand for, you know, patriarchal, repressed era.
Yeah.
And that Mary Lou immediately shows herself to be the opposite of everything we expect from that era. She goes to a confessional booth, tells the priest about all her like opening scene of the movie. Tells the priest about all the like, you know, all the hedonistic perverted things she's done, and laughs and says she enjoyed every minute, and writes her name and phone number on the. Her side at the confessional and lipstick. I mean, it's hard not to see this, even not even looking for subtext. Like, it's hard not to see this as this is a film about repressed feminine energy coming through in a time where it's being tramped down. I mean, you know, the fact that it's not just that, of course, she dies at her prom because she's in all of her open sexuality and all of her teasing, like she's very femme fatale. Like she, what you would consider, what you in that era would consider wicked. But you know, the fact she doesn't come back as a ghost just because, I mean, the principal of the high school now is her old boyfriend that she ended up spurning before she died, who's played by Michael Ironside. Now, if there was ever a guy who's like officious authoritarian man, yeah. It's like, I mean, it's like every role he plays is something in that realm, usually.
Exactly, yeah. Michael Ironside, he's usually associated as a tough guy.
Yeah, or he's like a government agent. Yeah. He's like a bureaucrat. Like he's just something. He's just some kind of criminal or government syndicate in power, and he's trying to exercise or maintain that power. So, but here he's much more sympathetic than his usual characters because he's a pretty, you know, broken guy. I mean, he's still. It's a very Nightmare on Elm Street premise because these teenagers are being hunted by the weight of their parents' mistakes and sins, which is, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street films go really well with this whole genre because usually it's like a final girl discovering her inherent powers to overcome the mistakes of her parents' generation and, you know, what they're the ways in which they're trying to keep secret their mistakes and keep her away from knowledge that's going to save her because they just don't believe her enough to know that she's in trouble. I mean, you know, all those teenage concerns and social concerns are tied up with this stuff in Nightmare on Elm Street, especially when you get to like Dream Warriors, Dream Master, even the first one, honestly. And, you know, Hello Mary Lou has elements of that. And of course, elements of the possession film, but the possession here isn't just like, it's not exorcist possession where it's just a vessel for like scary or gross shit to happen. Like, you know, it seems very personal. Like there's a bunch of people Mary Lou could have possessed at this school. She could have possessed like Kelly, the girl who's like modern Mary Lou.
Yeah.
But yeah. She went for the one that's the most, you know, the nicest girl who's got the most weight on her shoulders and the one who's like, she's not light, but she's from an uptight family. And she's got like, she's being pulled in a million directions at once by what's expected of her, which is the whole thing becomes kind of, she's absolutely the opposite of Mary Lou. I mean, the whole thing becomes this weirdly, as batshit as this film is, weirdly consistent, like, exploration of women dealing with social roles.
Yeah, I think that, and that's part of the appeal of the film is that taking a character like that and just making her do the complete opposite of what her character would do if she wasn't possessed. So definitely makes the film more interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think not a huge fan of most possession films, but because I think it's just kind of, you know, it's kind of a plot device. I always feel like the possessed character is like just part of the plot device rather than like actually gets any agency. So you sort of have a useless character at the center of the film. But Hello Mary Lou does so much more with that plot device by putting in all this other context and these other tropes. I think it works really, really well. And it's totally gotcha.
And so, before we wrap up the main topic, there are just other films that we could possibly throw in here. You mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street, like the first one, probably Part 3 and Part 4, Dream Warriors, Dream Master. They definitely have elements of power, telekinesis, whatnot. You know, the power to manipulate your own dreams and things like that. Another Wes Craven film that might fall into this also is Deadly Friend. Deadly Friend is another one. Just to throw those out there, you know, for people who are listening and are looking to maybe, you know, check out, you know, some of these films under this topic, there's a few more for you to check out. You know, probably not as heavily as some of these other films. The theme doesn't run through as heavily. But there's still elements of it there.
I'm a big fan of Deadly Friend, and that definitely fits here. One that bears some mention, I think, is Mirror Mirror from 1990.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And at this point, let's stop for just a second. Roxy is in the other room. So she's big into mirror, so I'd love to get her comments on this.
Sure, no problem. We'll just stick around for that.
Oh, take your time, sweetie. Roxy, not you. Unless you want me to call you sweet. Unless you want me to call you sweet.
I am uncomfortable with that.
It's an uncomfortable night all around.
Yeah. No. That's fun though. That makes it fun. You know, just you, reveling in our discomfort.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we're about to wrap this segment up once we get Roxy's thoughts on Mirror. And then we'll go.
Hi, Chris. I'm back. No problem. I know this has been a very embarrassing week for you.
Well, we're talking about Mirror, Rock. So you can go ahead and kick in with that whenever you're ready. Because I've got a chunk here that I'm going to edit out.
Great. All right. So Mirror. This is another possession movie. It's also... I guess you'd place it under cursed object movies, because the object in question here is a mirror, and we have a very interesting performance from our leading lady, who has the improbable and delightful name of Rainbow Harvest.
Excellent.
That's her real name.
That's awesome.
Yes! Like a lot of movies we talked about, there's also some intense lesbian subtext in this one, but... A lot of the movie deals with, women growing up and, you know, young girls trying to find their place in the world. And the idea of, like what you were saying about Hello, Mary Lou, the idea of a possession movie making somebody act like the antithesis of what they were before. It's also spawned quite a few sequels. Joel, I know you're a fan of this film, too. What do you think about Mirror? What are some notable things we could talk about?
Well, first of all, we haven't really brought up a lot of the makers of these films. Mirror is one of the few that's both directed and written by women. The director, Marina Sardenti, and I'm not sure she really did too many films. There's a few different screenwriters. Sargenti was one of them, but Annette and Gina Cascone were writing. So there were a lot of women actually making this, which is why it seems a little more accurate to the high school experience. A little exaggerated maybe, but only for the purposes of being a horror film, I think. It's. Our main character, Megan, played by Rainbow Harvest, is her mom is Taryn Black, which is amazing. It moved mm-hmm. into a new house, new neighborhood. Roxy, was her dad dead? Was that the
Her father passed away. She thinks about him a lot. They were close.
Megan is very god. She is definitely inspired by Lydia from Beetlejuice.
She looks like a cross between Lydia and the punk singer Nina Hagen for most of the film.
Oh, she does. You showed me. Yeah. What's interesting? There's definitely some satire in the high school stuff, because the alpha bitch of this high school is running for president against Megan's best friend, and the alpha bitch's name is Charlene Kane.
I love the Citizen Kane references in this film. There's a lot of visual references, too, with Charlene's poster. And, it's got, her face real big with, the word Kane. Oh, I love that.
I love that they took the time to parody Citizen Kane. For our Full Moon fans out there, Charlene is played by Charlie Spradling, who you probably know as one of Full Moon's catalog models and frequent actresses. She is in Puppet Master 2, among others. But, Megan and Nikki, your best friend. There's a very close sister relationship there, but tinged with some lesbian attraction. I mean, there's Megan seems pretty, pretty fluid in terms of attraction. She seems legitimately attracted to Charlene's boyfriend. I mean, it definitely is someone who's like, and of course, you know, a mirror being such an obvious metaphor, and like any story ever shows up in terms of for someone's identity or self-perception. I mean, Megan's identity seems very much in flux, and you know, she's confirmed as like, oh, I'm the school's new goth girl, but you know, she starts dressing a bit differently under the mirror's influence. It seems like maybe the goth look was also partly kind of a way to cement her identity in an era of her life that's just a complete disaster. I mean, her dad's dead and her mom is Karen Black. And Karen Black.
Her mom is nuts. And can I say, at the beginning, Megan's outfits are very goth. They're all black, and she's got studded leather and like all this makeup and everything. But she wears a really big black leather jacket. She looks like a turtle in her shell.
Yeah. And, you know, a part of me also thinks that there's sort of an underlying thing in this movie where it's kind of about mental illness, because I can't help but feel like she's like her mom is very, very obviously crazy. Like,
yeah.
I mean, partly in mourning, but also just completely nuts. And it's Karen Black, so yeah, completely nuts. I honestly think so much of what Megan's going through in this movie is wondering, am I inheriting this? Is this the way my future is going to look? I mean, not just like being miserable, but like actually not even being able to function really. Which is something that I think you could, like, those kind of themes that, like, mental illness themes, I mean, are sort of inherent to possession films. They are inherent to, like, even to telekinetic films, all of this stuff. I mean, witchcraft, of course. I mean, long historical pattern of accusations of witchcraft and illness being tied together. But Mirror lays that out pretty explicitly by showing you that her mom's not crazy in the way like Carrie's mom is. She's not a fundamentalist. There's nothing cultural about her madness. She's just demented because that's mentally who she is.
Right. Yeah. She's just regular crazy as compared to just like, you know, religiously crazy.
Yeah. She's not a fanatic or anything. She just looks like someone who really can't function day to day.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, so we get that. I think, any final thoughts on just girl power in general in films, guys?
I mean, one of the reasons I suggested this topic always interests me is that it's like a cultural meme that keeps popping up during really necessary times, almost, or at least like important times. I mean, one of the things, like I was mentioning when we were emailing the other day, one of the things that interests me is that lately during all the protests for women's health care, for Planned Parenthood, one of the memes that goes around that you see in signs of protesters, that you see in Facebook memes, like is variations on the quote, "We are the granddaughters of the witches you could not burn, your ancestors could not burn." Mm-hmm. You know, it's phrased on different ways. But, you know, it's the fact that, like, right now we've had another Carrie remake. We've had Starry Eyes, which is kind of a possession succubus film. We've had The Babadook, which is about a single mother dealing with grief. We've had just a lot of films in this realm, and it seems like every 10 years or so, culturally, this starts cropping up again. I mean, yeah, even before Carrie, you could say that this stuff was prevalent in the 60s with, like, Bewitched, Bell Book and Candle, I Dream of Jeannie.
I Married a Witch.
Back in, when was that, 43, I think, which is at a time when women are going to, are joining the workforce. Carrie crops up in the 70s after, like, years of discussion of abortion laws and the Equal Rights Amendment. It seems like every time there's a lot of discussion about women's health care, women's rights, like, you start getting these come out during movies. And I find that and other, you know, pop culture, but I find it really interesting that horror movies keep adopting this.
Wow. My final thoughts about girl power. It's pretty loaded, considering I am the only girl here. But I'll try to be brief. I love stories about the female experience. I love stories about women helping women. I think it's great that a lot of these are appearing when we need them. I would love to have more female-driven films where people react to them and it doesn't feel like tokenism. You know, people like are crying tokenism, or like you're doing that because it's trendy, or you're doing that because you're trying so hard to stay relevant. I'd like that to happen, and I think we've had, as I was saying, some really great horror movies by, for, and about women recently, and I think that's really great. I hope the trend continues. And I'd just love stories about, like, guy-girl friendship, stuff like that. I think that's kind of underrepresented. And that's all I have to say. That was my womany perspective.
All right. Thanks, Rocky. Well, that's the time for the final segment of the show. We call it the double bill spill, but since we have Roxy with us this week, we'll do the triple bill spill. So we get triple your movies for your viewing pleasure. And I'm going to start the things off. I'm going to go back to a horror film this week. I'm going to go with the film Society from 1989, directed by Brian Yuzna, who we're all familiar with here on this show. Movies, basically, I went with it because it's a solid mix of satire. There's some dark comedy in there, and we get, a thing kind of like Body Snatchers, where there's, like, some paranoia running through the film. And one of the more disgusting climaxes, I think, that you will see in a movie. It takes place within, somewhere in the last 10-15 minutes of the movie. And, it's, some people might find it tough to watch, because of that, but it's definitely, you definitely won't forget it if you sit through it and wait for that climax. So I'm kicking off with Society.
Yeah, I would have to certainly agree with you on that, Chris. If you see the last 10-15 minutes of Society, I guarantee you will absolutely never forget it. I mean, the whole movie, something is not right here, and once you see what it is so much worse than you ever imagined. I will say, there's not a drop of blood, but you'll almost wish that there were.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's all I have to say about that.
I think that's plenty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just giving everybody out there a friendly warning.
What you got, Joel?
Well, I haven't seen Society, but I know Brian Yuzna's work. I have a basic idea of the movie and what the tone is like. So Roxy and I were thinking about films that are very skewed versions of American suburbia, or just American families. So the one I went with is a favorite of ours, Meet the Hollowheads.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which, are you familiar with that, Chris?
I have not seen that in quite some time. Actually, but I can't remember a lot of it, but I know I've seen it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a very weird, skewed parody of, you know, it's got a fifth sitcom vibe. That seems like it was a really common thing around the late 80s and especially through the 90s to parody that sort of nuclear family sitcom. And it's like a family sitcom taking place in a world. It almost seems like it's inside the human body. I mean, everything is built on, like, tube structures, but they're not pneumatic tubes like clean Jetsons tubes. They're
everything is very visceral. It's almost like this movie has been described as Father Knows Best meets Eraserhead, and I would agree with that, but I would add H.R. Geiger into the mix because there's a lot of weird bodily imagery throughout the film, much like Society, but to a much lesser extent.
And it's, you know, it's one that plays it for, like, it's still a colorful film. It plays that stuff for laughs, or else just it's there and it doesn't comment on it. I mean, you know, if I had to compare it to anything, the weird thing is I would compare it to Rocko's Modern Life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. I mean, that was a show that actually had a sitcom within this animated sitcom about parasites living on the body of a dog. It's a pretty accurate comparison. I want to give a shout out to the co-writer of this film, Lisa Morton, who you know, I'm somewhat acquainted with. If you want to learn more about this film, you can Google her name and check out her website, because she has a very detailed diary chronicling the making of the film. She prefers that it be called by its original title, Life on the Edge, but if you are Googling the movie, it's impossible to find it under that title, so I would just suggest you Google Meet the Hollowheads, because you literally can't mistake it for any other film under that title. But if you saw it, you'd also never be able to mistake it for any other film. Yeah, this film was directed by Thomas R. Berman, the makeup artist. I think his most famous creation is probably Sloth from the Goonies.
Oh, Sloth.
But he directed this film. He co-wrote with Lisa Morton. They were trying to, you know, make kind of a simple movie that they could do something inventive with visually. And just check it out. That's all I have to say. I guarantee you it will leave an impression on you.
Okay, Roxy, well, what's your contribution to our triple bill spill then?
Okay, well, going on the theme with, you know, kind of taking the American family and turning it on its head, my pick is the comedy Eating Raoul, which is a movie I absolutely love. This is, directed by Paul Bartel, who you might remember from Death Race 2000, Private Parts, and many other cult films. This is a movie about his very rad bromance with his leading lady, Mary Warrenoff, who appeared in so many of his films, like Death Race 2000. In this movie, they were never romantically involved. They were just the best of buds. So in this movie, they play a married couple named Paul and Mary, very creative guys. And they're these hopelessly repressed people. Their dream is to open their own restaurant, but they seem to have funneled all the passion in their lives into that and into cooking and wine. But they live a very weirdly 50s repressed lifestyle. Like, they don't sleep in the same bed. They have all this creepy 50s furniture in their house. But anyway, like so many people in movies, they've got a dream. And their dream is to open their own restaurant. But of course, they don't have the money to do this. Well, they live in a neighborhood that is populated by a lot of swingers, I guess you'd say. Just creepy, kinky people. And, well, there's nothing wrong with being kinky. A man tries to break into their apartment and assault Mary. And in one of the only cases where this situation could end hilariously, they kill him. In self-defense, and then they get the idea to take his wallet, and they're like, hey, we could make a lot of money doing this, and then we're off to the races, people. They take out some personal ads saying that they are dominatrixes and thus lure people to their apartment. Raoul, played by Robert Beltran, for you Star Trek fans, although he doesn't like to talk about it. Is a locksmith who finds out about their plan when he's fitting the house for locks, and he decides to get in on this sweet gig, but who is going to double-cross who? And will they ever achieve their dream? You know, as they say, I'm reading Rainbow, don't take my word for it. You're just going to have to see the movie.
That's an excellent synopsis, Roxy. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
I guess that wraps it up for another show this week.
Whew!
Oh, I'm sweating through this one. And
yeah.
But it was a good one. Very informative. We discussed a lot of points on this one. And you're always welcome back, as I always say, Roxy. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
And I want to give my apologies once again to the Sinful Dwarf. And we bumped him again. There's a lot to discuss this week. And the Sinful Dwarf, I swear we're going to get you on. Promise.
He might be okay with having missed this episode.
This might have been a bit much even for him.
apologies to the Sinful Dwarf. So, Joel LaPuma for Roxy. And for myself, Chris Jordan. Thank you for your ears, and remember your mom and pop video store, because it is the cornerstone of your nostalgia. We will see you next week. If you'd like to